What do loco weeds and biscuit roots have to do with the Northern Pacific Railroad?
Wherever the railroad went, it was chewing up plants, and they were trying to replant new plants, and it was burning up stuff, and weeds came in, and there happened to be this man, John Lieberg, who was on the scene of all that right when the Northern Pacific first came across in 1883, and he was a plant lover. He couldn't help it. He was a Swedish immigrant, and he collected everything he saw. So there's specimen papers in the National Herbarium in D.C. that are from real wild parts of Montana that are loco weeds and biscuit roots, and they're his. It's pretty nice to see that.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Jack Nisbet about his nonfiction book, The Dreamer and the Doctor, a forest lover and a physician on the edge of the frontier. Don't go away. There's something really charming about this story that's titled The Dreamer and the Doctor, in which case the doctor, the physician, is a woman, and the dreamer forest lover is a man. And I wanted to know, how and when did this story first come to you?
In the circles that I travel in, they are around. I work in Montana and BC and Washington and Idaho, and there's a cult of women in North Idaho who think Carrie is really great, even though they know very little about her. And there's fire ecologists from Missoula and silviculturalists from different national forests that have told me about John Lieberg and his reports. And I stumbled on some oral memories of them from a guy whose grandparents ran a resort at a lakeside in Idaho and said, oh, yeah, the Liebergs used to come down all the time. And so I understood they were around and I understood they were interesting, but I didn't know that they were what I would call important and emblematic of what the place was and what it became until I really started digging into them. And that took a I'm slow, and it took a long time to understand it. But eventually, my wife helps me. My wife, Claire, helps me, and we do research together, and we found all these letters, one in the what is now the New York Botanical Garden and one at the National Archives because he worked as a summer seasonal for the Department of Agriculture and the USGS. So there are lots and lots of letters. And in John's file, there were letters from Carrie. And all of a sudden, she was a total black hole. All of a sudden, she's a terrific writer. She has a very dark view of life. She's very down about a lot of things a lot of the time, as many physician writers are. And I guess I'd read doctor writers all my life. I love Anton Chekhov and William Carlos Williams. And during the course of this, I was reading a British neurologist named William Marsh, and some of the syntax in all three of their stories sounds just like Carrie, going, these people who I'm treating and killing are so pitiful and they're so decrepit and the world is such an impoverished place and what can we do? I'm powerless. And Carrie has quotes just like that in her writings that are very powerful. And then she uses those to go do even more amazing things. For some reason, it doesn't drag her down. It uplifts her. And I'm intrigued by conflict like that. And I'm intrigued by the conflict that The Dreamer and the Doctor sounds like a book about a man and a woman in reverse.
Right.
And I'm intrigued by how they go against the grain all the time. All the time they're going against type. That's hard for a writer to resist.
I can't wait to talk a little bit more about Carrie's life and practice as a physician. But speaking of the tension and the conflicts, how did these two, John and Carrie, come together? Because there's a bit of a...
With a lot of tension and conflict.
Yes.
Again, I work with my wife. She does a lot of the research, and she's a terrific editor. So it takes us a long time to settle on a project. And I'm going, boy, you know, I think I want to write about these people. She kept saying he's not funny enough. There's this really dark things that they did. They both abandoned families, especially him. He abandoned a wife and with young kids, and the wife did not want to be abandoned. And you can think of it that way. You can think of it was an arranged marriage with another Swedish immigrant, and they were both young, and they grew apart. Again, you can't ever judge a relationship, and I decided not to do that. All you can say is they both came from other lives where many people would have just let it go and been done what they were doing. They're in the Midwest. But Montana and Idaho and Eastern Washington are full of immigrants who come to the New World, settle in the Midwest, and then chuck it all up and come west. And that's very appealing to me, and it's very reminiscent of other people that I've written about. And I like it. I like the idea. I'm going to throw my passion completely into something that I do right now. And I might do it for 10 or 20 years, and then I'm going to chuck it all up and go do it again. And the Liebergs do that several times during their lives. That is appealing to me.
We were talking before the interview about your own story of coming to Montana and Washington and the West. Is there anything that's resonant for you about chucking it all and starting something new and falling into a passion?
I grew up in the rural South near the Appalachians, and I went to Eastern Washington where the mountains are about the same size. It's logging, farming, and mining were the only things going on, and I had learned how to do all of those things as a kid. And a lot of the plants, and especially the birds, were familiar to me with what I knew from the southern Piedmont, but they were different. They were familiar but different. So I saw redstarts and bobolinks as a kid and loved them and came out here and there are redstarts and bobolinks. And that got me excited. And then there's all these other places to go. There's bigger mountains, there's more birds, there's new plants. So once I got unleashed here, it was very powerful. Yeah, this is a lifetime of exploration to get to it. And that's certainly the way John thought about it. He never stopped. He could not turn his mind off. Once he saw the Clark Fork Delta and these channels full of logs that all had these different mosses growing on him, he went out of his mind, basically. And his letters show that. It's great.
You brought up mosses. And about plant identification, you write, "Moss identification is an esoteric skill." And I wanted to know, what would you say about the mind of botanists or the minds or personalities of botanists?
Well, here's the thing, is I do natural history and have done it all my life and had to get more focus on plants. I'm not an expert in anything. Had to get more focus on plants when I did a book about David Douglas, who, of course, made a lot of the first collections that we're familiar with from anywhere in the West, Northwest. And I had got to know a lot of botanists doing that. A lot of them mentored me along in the art and craft of the discipline, and I just shared so much with them and learned so much from them. And you start talking about mosses to about 90% of them or maybe 95% of them, and their eyes just glaze over and they go, "Oh yeah, I just send those off to this crazy person, you know, in Wyoming who does mosses." Because they're different. The language of them is different. The sexual parts of them are different. And it takes a different kind of mindset to do it. And it involves looking through a microscope. Carrie, when she was in medical school, took a histology course and learned how to do microscopy and slide preparation. Mosses is about microscopy and slide preparation. And they had a good microscope, so there's every chance it was Carrie's. In this tiny homestead cabin they were in with a fairly intense kid crawling around on the floor. And Carrie describes John for hours and hours looking through his microscope, obviously ignoring her and the kid, and doing his work. And again, we would not know anything about any of this except he kept sending letters back to this remarkable woman, Elizabeth Britton, at what became New York Botanic Garden, who shepherded him along. He's an amateur, and I identify with that for sure, but he gets way past most amateurs, and they argue about these tiny little esoteric points of moss identification, but he always bows to Britton. But he comes along, he does these little doodles in his letters, he describes the scene, he's entranced with them. But then he's entranced with a lot of things. He's entranced with a lot of things, but he is a very obsessive person. A lot of naturalists become very obsessive, and I identify with all that. So it's fun for me to track him around. And I never did get into mosses. I had some moss people who really helped me. It was hard to find them. But I end up at the National Herbarium in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian going into a room, and there's all these people in there with electron microscopes doing stuff. I have no idea what it is. How did John do it in this little cabin with a microscope from 1890? The answer is, you can do anything. And these people, the people I did talk to, were very impressed and said, it's all about how you fold up your envelope so they can stay. And the origami of envelope folding is still revealed at this National Herbarium. And you can go, so this is how much I can understand it. We go look at the envelopes he folded. And the person who took me around said, "Man, he's folding some pretty good envelopes." So that's esoteric, right?
Right. If you were just to describe John Lieberg's legacy overall, you know, what would you say?
That's a good question. He is a very ambitious man. He makes it clear in these letters to Britain early on, before he ever has a job, is anything more than a prospector or a railroad guy. I intend to leave a mark in the scientific community. I'm not a mere collector. Horticultural collectors are, that's what the big guys in London said. David Douglas is a mere horticultural collector. And you can, like if you're on a ship in the British Navy, you don't get to eat with the officers. If you're a horticultural collector, you're nobody. And it's really a class thing. He doesn't have any kind of advanced degree. He's nobody. And he says he is determined to make his mark in science. And he didn't know what he was doing a lot of the time as far as how it would play out. But he was so focused all the time, and he kept some plant lists that I think are very important for a whole lot of areas in Montana, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, California, and Arizona. But his legacy turns out to be these forest reserve surveys that he started doing for the U.S. Geological Survey as Gifford Pinchot was starting to form the National Forest. He hired a bunch of really competent timber surveyors, most of whom worked for timber companies or for the railroad, and they were supposed to go out and just, how many board feet, what is the species associations look like in this place, like the Flathead National Forest, what is now the Flathead National Forest. They didn't know where the boundaries were or anything on the reserve. Lieberg did a large number of them, and he did a better job than anybody else. He included thoughts about who's living there now, what's the mining situation, is there any way you can ever grow crops there? What is the tree composition? What is the plant composition? What are the associations? How has it evolved over time? He uses that word all the time. He uses weather and climate all the time in his talkings. He's always paying attention to that. He's seeing things that he has an intuitive feel for landscape that is, I don't know, the people that I talk to and myself, we just don't see how he's doing it. We can understand where he's coming from, but he is like living inside the landscape. And I think it's based on like putting his face down into these wet mosses and smelling them just to feel them. That's what he's doing to the whole landscape.
I imagine that that's part of where his title as the dreamer comes to be.
Yes.
Can you, just for listeners, describe the area around Glacial Lake Missoula and the Bitterroot?
Lieberg, he got off the train in 1884 because he wanted to make money as a prospector, and he chose this very isolated drainage, the Little North Fork of the Coeur d'Alene River, and he homesteaded on the south end of Lake Ponderay, which is a beautiful lake in the Idaho Panhandle, and it's where this giant ice dam formed during the Pleistocene and over time broke and reformed and broke and reformed. And the lake that backed up from it was 200 miles long and came back all the way up the Clark Fork to Missoula, Montana, and up to Flathead Lake and down into the Bitterroot. And he worked both east and west of it. And the scientific basis wasn't there to really understand Cordillera and glaciers and outflow, outburst floods like they do now. But he was seeing it all and describing it all. And he would just say, oh, yeah, I thought that all the time, if he was reading some of the most modern papers on the Ice Age floods. He was inside the Ice Age floods. And his homestead was literally inside the Ice Age ice plug that made the floods.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Jack Nisbett about his work of nonfiction, The Dreamer and the Doctor, a forest lover and a physician on the edge of the frontier. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In regards to the tension between industrial development and forest management, I want to know what you meant when John Lieberg said, and you quoted him as saying, it won't be long before the West will make itself heard.
So any writer that's doing their work has reasons for doing it. And one of the big attractions for me is that the Lieberg story is about public health, which is Carrie, and public land management, which is John. And that's two issues we have done a terrible job of addressing in the last century. And my purpose when I go around with my little book tours is to just sort of get a very mixed audience that thinks in different ways about it and just lay out some of the beginnings of both and see what happens. And that's a very legitimate method. I mean, I'm good at going to real isolated rural towns all over the West and just talking about it. And that's where I learn how I want to write about it. So John is seeing the railroad and prospectors and farmers carelessly set fires and burn up, you know, a lot of the national forest in the Northwest, all over the place. He understands that the tribes used to set fires. He understands that fire is a natural part of the landscape. He understands that the forest has a lot of resiliency built into it. He's talking about that all the time. But he also sees how these hot fires can change the way water flows across the landscape and sterilize soils and get places into this situation where these dog hair growths of Doug fir or lodgepole come back, and then that's setting up for another fire, and then that sterilizes soil more, so dog hair comes back. And you get into this cycle that we are inside of today.
What is dog hair growth?
When there a fire goes through or when a clear cut happens, often if there's really a lot of seed, it comes back really fast, and you get a whole bunch of little seedlings growing very close together. And that's especially true of lodgepole because it's heat generated. So often after a fire, that's what comes back. But Douglas fir comes back that way too because it puts out so many seeds. And the problem is if nobody thins them or if the conditions are just right, you just get these trees growing very close together and they can't mature into sawlogs, which is what we want, or beautiful big trees, which is what we want. All you have is this jumble of seedlings that's all ready to burn. None of them are really healthy. They're all real skinny, and they're just fuel. That's what they're called now, is fuel, which, if you live in the West, is a bad word. Fuel load is what you don't want to hear. Again, he wouldn't be surprised at all. Mm-hmm. He's living through smoky summers like we live through, like anybody in the West lives through, and he's trying to think about the long term. How do you address the problem? And there's all these public lands out here. There are no rules. And he says there has to be some management rules. How are we going to do this so it makes sense in the long term? So the BLM is the Bureau of Land Management, a federal organization. DNR is the Department of Natural Resources, which each state has, and each state runs their own differently. But in the West, a lot of them have considerable amounts of land that plays into these management kind of strategies that Lieberg's trying to organize. The Forest Service was an attempt to do that and still is, and BLM is an attempt to do that, and DNR is an attempt to do that. And all the lands that you can travel around in this amazing place that we live, there's a lot of public land left. It has these different ownerships. It has different fates. He thinks about all of it. He couldn't stop himself from thinking about all of it. And the people who turned me on to him are like him. They're saying, what are we going to do? We've put ourselves in a bad situation. It's going to be a long time before we get out of it. We need to stretch out our understanding of time and quit being so moment-centered and think about it in a larger scale. We have to change our scale. Well, again, if you study mosses, you are changing scales all the time. And Lieberg's looking through this microscope, looking at little peristomes on mosses that are the width of a human hair and seeing tiny details in them, lifting his head up and writing about the larger scale weather systems that are coming across Lake Monterey. It's a very unusual talent. Not very many people can switch back and forth so easily. I love that. And again, that was one of the things that really attracted me to the story. So public land, public lands, public health. That's what that quote is about. Mm-hmm. And he says, and again, this is something you might have heard, is he's writing letters back east. If the politicians back east can pass all the laws that they want, unless they listen to local knowledge and get input from the West on how this is what should work and needs to work, it's not going to make any difference because the West will just rebel against it. And they won't stand for it because they live here. That's part of this ongoing story that we are trying to understand. And Washington, D.C., in some ways, hasn't changed very much.
This term local knowledge you bring up even before the book begins, because even their names, you know, they might be professionally actually known as the Liebergs, but you wrote in this case, local knowledge wins because the commonplace is Lieberg. Is that correct?
The people who live in around Lake Ponderay who have this faint memory of him call him Lieberg. Every botanist I know calls him Liburg because Leipzig, Germany is pronounced Leipzig. But again, John always addresses everything. And he writes, so the Steens Mountains in eastern Oregon that we call the Steens Mountains and spell S-T-E-E-N used to be spelled S-T-E-I-N. And John writes a fairly hysterical couple pages back to his boss who's on the Geographic Place Names Committee trying to figure out what they should name them and how they should spell it. And he goes through most of Central and Northern Europe saying, well, if they were in Denmark, but if this part of Sweden pronounces EI like this, but you know, in Southern Germany, they pronounce EI like this. It depends on where you're from and who you're learning from and what your family is. And he never mentions Liburg at all, but the Steens Mountains is the Steens Mountains because Mr. Steen pronounced it with the long E. And again, you have to love it. Right. And local usage is how things work. Language evolves over time, just like plants do or forests do or laws do. And Liburg is all about that, but he's very strict about making it his way. He wants to understand how it evolves. And if somebody's wrong, they're wrong. He always thinks he's right about it.
You've taken me right to the place of the intersection of tribes and language. And you actually include some of the Coeur d'Alene tribal perspective. And from Felix Arepa, an elder who recently died, in reference to indigenous people embracing both modern conveniences and traditional ways, you quote Felix as saying, people can speak two languages, can't they? And I was wondering if you could speak to how you address the indigenous landscape, you know, that underlies all this sort of frontier mentality and Anglo-Saxons coming across the land and thinking maybe that we know things.
So I started out trying to address my world through doing research and reading fur trade journals or letters and that kind of thing, and thought that I could figure out a story that way. And when I published a book, or when I was about to publish a book about David Thompson, I took a trip. I met tribal people early on in the little valley that I lived in, realized they had things to say and could visualize time, and had this scale that allowed time to flow for many generations instead of just your dad and your grandma, and that was essential. I did know that, but I hadn't put it into my writing until I took a canoe trip with an elder, James Salam, who understood what I was doing, didn't give me too much grief about it, but said that I needed to think about what this guy David Thompson was missing.
Who is David Thompson?
David Thompson's a fur trader who was the first person to survey and write about the whole Columbia. And so he opened up and had a lot of first contact with tribes in northwest Montana, northern Idaho, eastern Washington, and southern BC.
One of the most poignant medical pieces I read in the book was Carrie's experience of a double pregnancy.
Oh, ouch.
Can you describe that briefly?
A double pregnancy is when two eggs get fertilized. And in Carrie's case, she's talking about one outside the womb and one inside the womb. And outside the womb is in the fallopian tubes. And it's called an ectopic pregnancy. And it is not a good thing at all. So Carrie wants to be a general practitioner. We did meet a descendant, a great niece of hers who was 99. When I talked to her, totally cogent, she says, yeah, you know, the way the family story tells it is she always wanted to be a doctor, but of course she couldn't be a doctor in 1860 or 70 in New England because there are no women doctors. And she figured out a way to do it. It involved marrying somebody more than twice as old as she was, but it worked out. And she got her medical degree. She wanted to be a family practitioner. And again, this is a woman's issue. There's a whole woman's movement based on hygiene and gambling and booze because there's all these women living in poverty and having one kid after another in dire circumstances with a lot of problems that come up in these pregnancies. And the husband is gambling away the paycheck or drinking away the paycheck. So she really wanted to address those issues. So she was a family practice physician, even though she was a surgeon for the Northern Pacific. And the letters that she wrote and the medical journals that she published, which are several, involved pregnancies gone wrong. And what could be worse than an ectopic pregnancy where the egg gets fouled up outside, in the fallopian tubes, outside the womb, and, all these things happen. Those of us who read James Herriot as kids and everything that he does is a collapsed uterus or a double pregnancy or something, it reads like that, except it's human, and it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really tough to read. And if you read Carrie's letters, it's really tough for her to go through. She has a very high failure rate in what she's doing. And that is hard for anybody to swallow. And the fact that she's also living it, that she has a child who has problems, only adds to all this. And yet, as I said before, somehow this only drives her. It is her engine. When she tries to start a lying-in facility in Spokane for women who have problems with pregnancy so they might not die in the cabin that they're in, that's modern times. I mean, there's only 4 lying-in hospitals in Chicago at the time. It's a whole new movement. She goes to Chicago to check them out and then comes back and tries to start one in Spokane, and then one starts in Spokane. She's under the radar in all this, but she's thinking she should be a hero to the woman's movement of that time. But there's lots of women who are completely unknown, who we don't know because they weren't entered into history yet at that time.
Right. Lastly, Jack, you highlight a quote from John Lieberg. Even the best and most prudent of men sometimes are cornered and perhaps obliged to choose between the horns of a dilemma, either of which is sharp, pointed enough to leave behind painful and lasting stings. I want to know, have you experienced this in your life? And where do you find your own prudence?
Yeah, we've all experienced that. And John Lieberg is an especially good example of it, where all he wanted to do was help the forest and make these rules and manage things so that they worked. And he was a seasonal for the Forest Service, which I know many in our listening and your listening audience have done in their lives. And he finally got on permanently and got to be the ranger in his favorite forest in the Clearwater. And he was gone in 8 months. He couldn't have a regular job. And he saw it as a moral dilemma. They wanted him to play by the rules and do what their new rules were. And he couldn't. He wanted to make the rules himself and live by his rules. And so he gets all on his high horse about it. It's pretty funny. But it's also so true, for people think they know what they want. And everybody thinks that this is where I want to get to and this is my dream job. John lived his dream job his whole life. He really did. He did what he needed to do every minute of his life. And it was unfortunate he got a real job there for a few months, but he got over it. He quit and got rid of it. And the horns of the dilemma, I just think, is classic Lieberg. He's all about making these wacky literary references and metaphors and everything. And it's easy to pull all these high-sounding sort of romantic quotes from him that are great, as long as you remember that he's out living it, that he quits this job and he is in the Philippines doing a forest survey within a few months, because that's what he does. He goes out and lives it, and that was his genius. So he got to do that. He tried to make himself not do it, and he couldn't, is the way I look at that.
Jack Nisbett lives and works with his wife Claire in Spokane, Washington. He's an award-winning biographer of the cartographer David Thompson and naturalist David Douglas. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.